I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith.
By God's grace, Alcoholics Anonymous, rooms full of people like you and a little effort on my own. I haven't had to take a drink or do any dope since May the 11th, 1976, and for that I'm especially grateful. I'm grateful to be here. I want to thank the committee for inviting me to participate. It's a privilege to be able to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thank my home group for coming, supporting my sobriety, and I'm fortunate. I'm sober a little over 23 years, and the people that saw me come in are still in my life. The little guy that 12-stepped me, little Jack Callahan, is still alive. He lives in Fullerton, California, and I call him every Tuesday, and he always tells me the same thing. He reminds me of how cool I was when he came to my house on May the 10th, 1976. He also asked me where I'm going to talk, and I tell him, and like last Tuesday, he told me to be sure and tell you folks that I wouldn't have anything to say if it weren't for him. So I'm grateful for that. My first sponsor is in the room, Rotten Ron, the infamous Rotten Ron, sitting over here with my group, and he saw me at my best when I knew everything. You know, how much you have to know before you don't know anything? Well, ask your sponsor; they'll tell you. And I'm grateful Ron's still around, and I'm grateful for the old timers. It's been a good weekend. It's been a fantastic bunch of speakers. I know them, and I've been on programs before with them, and it's good. And I'm grateful to be sober and to be a part of this. I have some friends here in the room that that I get to see at various places like this that mean something to me. That have some longevity. I'm talking about some longevity, some friendships, good, bad, or indifferent. It's good to be together. And I'm grateful for those things, just to be sober. The world is a safer place because I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody that knows me is glad I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm glad I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, my wants and my needs are exactly the same. I want to be here, and I need to be here. My wife would have liked to have come with me this weekend. She had to stay home. She's a president of World Service or something like that, and so she had to stay home and take command of the World Service for Al-Anon and keep them all shaped up. And other than that, why, she would have been here to support me. We've been together 39 years. We fit, you know. But she's grateful I'm sober and that I'm doing something in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new, relatively new, if you're sitting here today and, you know, get your body and your butt and your mind in the same place for a few minutes here, and I'll share a little AA with you. I don't know if I was born an alcoholic or not, but when I had my first drink, an alcoholic was born. And I had my first drink at a very early age, and I remember it because it did for me just exactly what alcohol is supposed to do for you. It made me so I didn't care. And I had all those feelings that alcoholics have. We talk about it all the time. I didn't like them. I didn't understand them. I didn't know what they were. I come from a family of alcoholics. It isn't necessary to come from a family of alcoholics to end up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm at least a fifth generation alcoholic, and that's as far as I wanted to check. I didn't feel like there's any need to go any farther than that. I grew up with selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, neurotic, insane people, and I got out of there alive. And I don't hold it against them at all. I don't hold any kind of grudge, or never have, really, you know. I mean, matter of fact, 36 years old, I ended up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous full of selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, neurotic, insane people. And you said, welcome, you're home, you know. And some of the tools that I learned to survive in my own family have been very essential in me surviving right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I don't hold anything against them. I was born in Texas, and that doesn't necessarily make you an alcoholic. It's a disease of its own. But so that you don't know the difference between a Texas tale and a fairy tale starts out once upon a time, and a Texas tale starts out, you're probably not going to believe this shit, but I'm going to tell you anyway. My dad's a lawyer, and I've never resented that. I kept him on retainer for years. He's also a drunk. He's sober now, but he was a drunken lawyer and had a lot of guilt, and that was good. We ended up in drunk tank together. I said, how are you going to represent me? You know, you're in here in jail with me, you know. He said, we'll both be in court at the same time. He said, "Don't worry, I know the judge."
Yeah, right.
Yeah. My dad's 84 years old, and I got 14 months of seniority on him in AA, and I don't ever let him forget it. I always wanted to one-up my old man. I didn't know I was going to have to go to A&A to do it, but, you know, good. We're good friends, my dad and I. You know, family recovery is my story, and Alcoholics Anonymous to put a family back together. And my dad and I are good friends. He called me the other day, and he played about 18 holes of golf and made love to a 69-year-old woman twice. And this year he made love to the woman before he played golf. You know, I'm my father's son. I want to be just like him, you know what I mean? But he's cool. And he still lives back in the Texas-Oklahoma panhandle, and I get to see him frequently, and it's good. Yeah. My wife and I, like I said, we've been together 39 years, and we went through a lot of the disease together. We have a daughter that's 36 years old, and she just gave us a granddaughter a couple of 3 months ago, and she lives in Milan, Italy. She's lived over there for 15 years. Very active member in the Al-Anon program. She has 23 years in the program. My wife has 23 years in the program without any sabbaticals or leave of absence or, you know, regular, continuous, active program. And I'm grateful for that because that's what I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous. I brought a family to Alcoholics Anonymous. Sick disease of alcoholism run rampant through my life. And I've been that way for a long time. When I drank, I just got in a lot of trouble. You know, there's basically three kinds of people in the world. There's people who wait for things to happen, there's people who watch things happen, and then there's people that make things happen. And I'm just one of those guys that makes stuff happen, and wherever I go, I get in trouble. I'm also was a hyperactive child at an early age. My uncle was a doctor, and they diagnosed me as hyperactive, so they gave me amphetamines to slow me down. And to this day, I don't know why you'd give somebody who has an abundance of energy speed, but... Hey, you know, I didn't argue. It's like going 190 miles an hour if your feet nail the floor. You know, I loved it. I had an acquired taste immediately, and it enhanced my drinking, and consequently why that just kept me going a little bit more. By the time I was 16, 17, 18 years old, I'd been married and divorced a couple of times, and I'm not stupid. I mean, I may be sick, but I'm not stupid. One of those ladies I married, her dad was one of the 10 richest men in the state of Texas. You know, I noticed that, and you know, after 9 months of that marriage, my father-in-law called me in and said, you know, I got a lot of money. And I said, yeah, I noticed that. And he said, well, I didn't get this kind of money by making bad investments, and you're a bad investment. And so they annulled me, and whatever that means. Yeah. And, you know, I was doing a little free enterprise down in Texas. I was transporting a little bit of non-habit forming marijuana. I wasn't smoking the stuff. I was selling it. And there's a difference, you know. And if I was smoking it, I'd have to go to NA. But selling it, you can come to AA, you know. Anyway, I got in a little trouble down in Fort Worth, Texas. Got busted and gotten some... The heat was on and I had to do a little time. And I got out and... You know, called up my two very best friends, Oily and Goose, and I said, you know, meet me at the train station in Amarillo, Texas. I'll be there in a little bit, and they give me $100 a suit, and I got a jug of whiskey and got on a train and headed for Amarillo, and I drank that whiskey and rolled into Amarillo, and they were sitting there in an old Chevy pickup. The battery had gone down because they'd been there a day and a half, listened to the radio, and I had some Benzedrine, some moonshine, and I crawled off that train and took a handful of bennies, standing out there on that depot, and chased it down with some white lightning. Man, it just blew me back against the wall. Bam! God, that's the best stuff I ever had in my life. You know what I mean? Nothing had even happened yet. You know what I mean? But it, just anticipation. Just loved it. And I crawled in that pickup truck, and I started telling Oily and Goose, you know, that I need to quit hanging around with them guys. I get in trouble when I hang around with them guys, and I need to stay away from them sick women. You know, you line 10 women against the wall over there, and I'll get the sickest one out of the bunch every time. And, you know, I got to stay out of them honky-tonks and, you know, stay out of them fast cars. And they agreed with me, you know. Yeah, right, you know. Saturday night, about midnight, we rolled into a little country dance down there on Wolf Creek, and it was intermission. The band took a break, and there was a stage up there, and they were gone, and everybody was going outside either to fiddle, whittle, or diddle. I don't know what the hell, but them old hairy-legged boys were leaning up against the wall over there, and I rolled a Coke bottle up and bumped the stage and said, let the meanest sucker in the house bring it back. I'm home. And a couple of drunks charged me, and I hit the first one and then ducked into the woman's restroom, because if you hang around a fight like that too long, get your helmet ratted. So as I went into the woman's restroom, there's a lady standing there, and I said, "Tell me when the fight's over." And pretty soon she stuck her head in that bathroom and said, "You can come out now, cowboy." And I come out, and the band's playing. She's handy, and I'm a quick study. And I said, "Want to dance?" And sure, you know, and the dance. I said, "Where you been? I haven't seen you around." She said, "Where you been? I haven't seen you around." "Well, I just got out of penitentiary." She said, "Well, I just got out of an unwed mother's home." And I said, "Hell, baby, we deserve each other, you know?" You know, sick attracts sick. And, you know, she had a car, driver's license, money in the bank, a job, all those things. I mean, everything that meet my requirements. I didn't have any of that, you know? And, so we set up a little light housekeeping, and we dated for 2 weeks, and they nicknamed us Hatchet and Hammer. Yeah. I found out 2 weeks, it wasn't even 2 weeks, man. Within a week of going with her, I knew she finished the fight I started. You know what I mean? It was just violent, two violent, physically violent people. And I'm not going to debate with anybody whether verbal abuse is worse than physical abuse, because I was talking to you when I was kicking your ass. I give it my best shot. But, I mean, she'd hammer me every which way I could look. You know, she wasn't afraid of nothing. And I knew it was love because there was just so much pain in it. It couldn't have been anything else, you know. It's got to be love, you know. And we went together 2 years, and she said she was pregnant, and I don't remember that. I must have been crossing over the invisible line when that happened. So, you know, I said, "Push the car around the block. If you don't miscarry, don't marry. You're healthy." You know, I mean, I didn't. Oh, I mean, it's just. What do you want me to do? Take a course? I don't know, you know. And she was healthy, and we got married, and she had a little girl, and she got a job, and had a job, and I'm a thief. I don't like to work. I like to steal. I have very little guilt, except right when I get caught, you know. Then you have a little guilt immediately, but it's short-lived, because you got to figure out what to do to get out of trouble, you know. It's time to feel guilty. And I was just doing whatever I could do and surviving. And it was just insane. And started to move to California. A friend of mine named Lion Shorty told me I could get a job on a ranch 40 miles west of Long Beach. And I didn't have sense enough to know that was ocean. You know what I mean? Oh, ye of little faith, what the hell, you know? So, we loaded up everything, took off for California, her and the kid and the dog and the cat and old station wagon and trailer with stuff behind, you know, and we took off. I stopped and got a baggie full of pills on the way out of there, you know, and it took us a month to go from Oklahoma City to Los Angeles. Most people can do it in 3 days, you know, it's just insane. And the old dog would stand behind me and drill all over the back of my neck, you know, and chase trucks down the side of inside of that station wagon. The seats were down, and he'd bang his head on the back window, fall on a cat that have a dog and cat fight. The kid would start bawling. She'd start bitching. I'd start drinking. We did that one day at a time for 30 days. I didn't live a whole lot different when I drank than I do now. I just lived like there was no tomorrow, you know. We got to California, and I found a drunken uncle. He got me a house right next door to a bunch of motorcycle gang lived on one side of me, and a bunch of hippies lived on the other side of me, and we moved right in there, you know, and we were comfortable there. I'd never seen no hippies before. They were dropping that LSD and laying in the front yard naked watching the sun come up and go down. You know, I'd never done nothing like that, but, you know, I mean, what the heck? So I went over, and they gave me some acid, and I went to see 2001, and, you know, I never questioned it, you know. It's just... And it just got sicker and sicker and sicker. And I'd take off and go do my thing. And I'd travel around. I worked in the oil fields. So I'd take off and go to Alaska. And I'd go to Louisiana. And then I'd come back through, you know. I'd be gone a month or so. And I'd come home and I'd bring all these guys with me, you know. They don't want to go home and fight with their wives. So they come over and watch me fight with mine. You know. And they'd stand behind me and say, "Get her." It's your old bros, you know, stand by. "Get her, get her. Step to the head of the line, hoss. She's got a butcher knife up here, you know." I passed out on my wife one time 15 minutes into a two-hour conversation. They don't like that. And she stabbed me all over my back with that butcher knife. And I came to. I said, "God, something's wrong with my back." She said, "Oh, let me see." You know, they got to act like they don't know. Peeled my old shirt off my back. "So you broke out of acne of the back. You've been drinking that rot gut whiskey." He said, "I'll get the rubbing alcohol and rub you down, you know." Them Baptists have been trying to baptize me for years and get me close to Jesus, but that alcohol bath got me closer than anything I'd ever had, I guess. I ended up in front of a judge, and the judge talking to me about me, and he had the right guy, you know, just nuts. And, in the course of that deal, somebody come through the halls of the courtroom there and handing out pamphlets to Alcoholics Anonymous, so I took one, you know, stuck it in my pocket just in case. I didn't know what it was. I didn't clue what AA was. You know, I've been doing B&B myself, you know, and stuck it in my pocket, and I went in front of that judge, and he had my file there, and a lot of physical violence in there and a bunch of stuff, and I've been arrested about 50 times for assault and battery and resisting arrest. And it wasn't that I wasn't a fighter, just that, you know, fear is a strange emotion, you know, and people that get afraid, they either hunker down or they accelerate, and I drove fear like a fast car, so I just, you know, would go zinging into those situations. And the judge sends me to 3 to 5 years, and I whipped that pamphlet out and said, "I'm going to AA," you know, and, "Oh, okay, well," you know, so they took me in the back room with my parole officer and lawyer and people, and sent me to go to some Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and I didn't know what the heck it was, so, you know, I have nothing to fear, I'll go, you know. And so this guy came and got me and took me home, and my wife had been to see a lawyer, and the lawyer suggested I go to AA, so I let her think it was her idea. She said, "You need to go to AA." "Good, all right, well, we'll go," you know. And they already told me about a meeting that was close to my house, and along about 8 o'clock, she'd asked me what time the meeting started, and I said, "I think it's at 8:30, and it's over 10 or something, I don't know." And I'm laying on the couch, and she came over and stuck that butcher knife in my face and said, "Get up." And, you know, I got up, and we went out and got in the old Pinto station wagon, and she took me over to this church, had her and the kid and the dog and the cat, everybody in the old Pinto, you know, I had one of them mustard brown Pinto station wagons, you know. Went down the road crooked, you know. And I remember pulling up in front of that AA meeting, a big AA sign over there. And I remember thinking, "Well, I've sunk to the bottom now." Yeah. Boy, you talk about low bottom snobbery, you know. I'm sitting out there in a Pinto station wagon, one of them old mustard brown, they only made them 1 year, you know. Had a hell of a deal on them, and I'm holding the muffler, pulled up in front of there, you know, and I'm afraid somebody's going to see me. I mean, my house is painted 4 different colors. There's a Corvair and Edsel parked in the front yard. They had a door jam in my house that ain't exploded wide open, you know, and motorcycle stuck in the front of the house, and I'm pulling out in front of an AA meeting, and I don't want anybody to know I'm going for help, you know. I got everything under control because I'm just on the verge of solving all my problems. My wife sensed my approach avoidance, stuck that knife in my face and said, "What time is the meeting over?" And I said, 10, I think. She said, "I'm going to tell you something, Ace. If your ass comes out of that door before 10, I'm going to gut you." I went into that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I sat in there, and I looked around, you know, I counted all the squares in the ceiling, the holes in the ceiling, the hairs in your ears, and the hairs in your back of your head. I thought, "Man, when I get old, I'm going to have hairs growing out of my ears," you know. And all the light bulbs that was out, I didn't identify. I wouldn't have drank with anybody in that room, much less sell them dope, you know. And I just, you know, I sat in there and looked out the door, and she was parked right outside the door, you know. So I stayed in that room. I went to one meeting a week, and I went home late on the couch. And then the next, you know, Monday came along while she'd come over there, and I'd get up, and I'd go get the old pin on. We'd go over there to that meeting, and I'd lay in there, look around. You know, I didn't hear nothing. I didn't ask anybody anything, you know. I'm sure that, you know, people looked at me and knew that I wasn't anywhere near ready, and I'm sure they didn't want to mess with her, you know. And, you know, the sad part about it, there was an Al-Anon meeting right next door, but there wasn't nothing wrong with her, you know. I went to one meeting a week for 4 months and didn't do anything. You know, just didn't drink, didn't use anything. And that was the most miserable time of my life that I remember up to, including that time. My wife said it was the best we'd had in years, but I mean, I didn't. I don't know, but amazing thing about, you know, if you don't drink, what, you know, attitudes and views will change with times and places. And so, you know, there I am, and I got that trust back. I beat the deal down at the courthouse. And, you know, got the trust back in the house. And she asked me if I wanted to take the car and go to the meeting. I went over to the meeting, you know, and resigned from Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and got struck drunk immediately. That's what happened to me. I got struck drunk immediately. And my life changed, too, I can assure you. Never gets better. It always gets worse. I remember one old fool over there one night said, "We won't guarantee after tonight you've had your last drink, but we'll guarantee you'll never enjoy another one." God, I hated him. He drives through the parking lot drunk looking for him, trying to run over him. You know? found out later he was slippery. He never went back to that meeting either. He was probably out there drunk. I probably drank with him, didn't even know it. You know. But for the next 4 years of my life, I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous more out than in. And I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous drunk, went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous sober. Went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous sober, got up at the coffee break, went and got drunk, came back, sat down. You know, came out of a blackout one time in an AA meeting. That's scary. I'm not sure who took you. You know, afraid to leave. No telling what will fall you out. And, you know, God, went to one of them Alcathon things one time. Got drunk and sober 4 times one day in AA. You know, just... I never really disturbed anything. I just get drunk, you know, and sit in there, you know. And it's, I don't know if they call that controlled drinking, but that's miserable drinking, you know. And you just kind of get to some point where you give up. I could remember, you know, sitting in those meetings, Alcoholics Anonymous, and thinking about the first time I got in trouble, it cost me $100 to get out of trouble. And then I think, well, you know, the next time I got in trouble, it cost me $200, and then it cost me $500, and then it cost me $1,000, and then it cost me $5,000 to get out of that one. And the last 4 years of my drinking, I sit in those meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and in and out of trouble, in and out of trouble. And, you know, the book says waves of the past will follow us in here, and I had me some waves following me, and I had some trouble. And, you know, my whole family's like that. My daughter lived in the back of that house like a wounded animal with hair in her face, and she ran around and made weird noises and kept all the, you know, the things that meant something to her in a old brown paper bag. You know, I remember standing in my kitchen, take a drink out of a bottle, look down the hallway. A little 9-year-old girl standing at the end of that hallway. She got her chin on her chest and her hair's in her face. And she didn't run down the hallway and say, "Daddy, come play with me." She just looked at me and I looked back at her and I took another drink. Not because I was ashamed of what I saw. Hell, I was way past shame. There's a place you can go in this disease that'll take you way past shame. There's a gray zone where you can go live that's even beyond hate. Because I had that phenomenon of craving, and it was absolutely necessary for me to take a drink. The only thing my daughter wanted to know was which direction I was going, so she'd go the other way. I know what it's like standing in my bathroom, and I'm putting that stuff in me. I turn around, and I look in the mirror, and the reflection in that mirror is a 10-year-old girl looking at me through the hole in the door in the bathroom where I probably stuck my foot sometime. Her eyes meet mine, and I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that what I'm putting in me's got me. I don't have it. I no longer have a choice. I knew that. It was a conscious thought. I also knew that no prayer that I could utter was going to stop it. I knew no hope. I knew no faith. Absolutely total hopelessness. The insanity of knowing that no matter what you know, I believe the definition of an alcoholic is a drunk with a conscience. I would sober up and I would look at me, even when I was half drunk, I'd look at me and I'd know beyond a shadow of a doubt, I don't want to be this way, I don't want to act this way. Something inside of me knew the difference between right and wrong, but then I'd put some more kind of chemical in me, and then that it would work, and I would no longer know the difference between right and wrong. And my daughter would look at me in that mirror, and I'd look at myself. And she didn't say, "Daddy, what are you doing? Come play with me. Please don't beat me and Mommy." She didn't say any of those things. She'd look at me, and all she wanted to know was which direction I was going, so she'd go the other way. I know what it's like to crawl out of the back of that house on my hands and my knees. I got to have a drink. Everything about me screaming. I need a drink. Don't you understand? I need a drink. That's the only conscious thought I had, way beyond prayer, way beyond any logic or moral code, way beyond anything that I'd been to, Alcoholics Anonymous or baptized or any of those things. I crawled down a hallway because there's something screaming inside of me, screaming louder than anything that's ever screamed before. I got to have a drink. I need a fix. I got to have something. Just over and over and over, I know to crawl. I got to, talking to myself, I got to have it, I got to have it, I got to get something. Like, where is it? I got to get it. And I crawl in my daughter's bedroom and I reach my hand underneath her bed and I pull a Raggedy Ann piggy bank out and I bust that piggy bank. And a big time slick like me, I'm on my hands and my knees and I'm stealing my daughter's money. And the alcoholic ego, we've talked about it a lot here this weekend. The alcoholic ego, I'm on my hands and my knees, and I'm separating the pennies, nickels, dimes, and the quarters because I ain't taking no pennies down to the liquor store or the Connections House. I'm going to be showing silver when I go. See? I don't know about you, but when I'm doing stuff like that, I got eyes in the back of my head, and on my hands and my knees, I glance over my shoulder, and a little 10-and-a-half, 11-year-old girl is hiding in the closet behind me. And she didn't go to school that day because she had a black eye and a busted lip, and I was pretty sure I had something to do with that. And just easier to stay in that closet that day than to go to school, because you see, if she goes to school looking like that, they come and get Daddy and take him away, or Mommy. And that ain't bad, that gives her a rest. But then I get out, and I come home, and then there's hell to pay. Because you see, when you catch me doing those kind of pitiful, incomprehensible, demoralizing things, it's absolutely necessary for me to inflict some kind of a painful memory in your mind that overshadows what you saw me doing. You can bet your sweet bippy you just don't know when it's coming. Being the very best father I could be that day, I give that kid a break. I let her shoot out behind me without inflicting any more pain in her life. That steals people's souls. Being the very best father, we talk about jealousy and envy when we're drinking like that, and then how it affects us when we're sober. I wanted my daughter to love me more than anything in the world. I've been a lot of places, joined a lot of clubs and gangs and crap like that, but the thing that tore my ass off was the way I was treating my family when I knew it was wrong. I love those people. They're part of me. They're my family. They're part of my blood. We can't deny those things, and the alcoholic knows that kind of pain when they're doing those kind of things. Coming out of a 10-day running drunk, come home and laid down on the couch and passed out. I had a 9-shot 22 pistol laying on my chest. And my daughter, when I came to, laying across the room, 6 feet away from me, laying on her back, hair in her face, she's dirty. The only friend she had was a little Cocker Spaniel dog she drug in off the street. And that dog's licking her in the face, and I came to and looked out of one eye, and I saw that dog licking that kid in the face. That dog was loving my daughter better than I could, and the jealousy and the rage and the envy inside of me made it absolutely necessary for me to shoot that dog 9 times. The last time I shot that dog was in the eye, 6 inches from my daughter's head, and her mother was standing 6 feet away, and nobody cried. Nobody cried. Because you show any kind of emotion, you're next. I'm talking about alcoholism, terror. Terror, bewilderment. Bewilderment and terror. You see, I'm dying. And you love me. Stand in front of a judge in a little town over in Beatty, Nevada. The judge is talking to me about me, and he's got the right guy, and I've taken a guy's life in a bar fight because I've been on a 10-day run and drunk over there, and I got in a fight, and I hit a guy, and it killed him, and he's went down as a justifiable homicide self-defense. Inside of me, I knew it wasn't. I knew it wasn't, and I knew the wrong guy died. And standing in front of that judge that day, there's something screaming 2 inches behind my belly button. The wrong man died. Don't you understand? You got to do something about me. You got to take this thing. You got to stop this thing. Except that isn't what showed on the outside, because the alcoholic ego is standing, and I got that smirky smile on my face because my bros are sitting over here on the other side, and I got to show them that I'm a cut above. And I stood in there that day, and what bewildered that judge was that I stood there, and he was talking to me about me, and he had the right guy. And I showed no visible sign of guilt and remorse. State of Texas said I was a sociopath. And it's strange, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says men and women drink for the effect. The effect is, after some amount of consumption, we can't distinguish the difference between true and false, right and wrong. That's the definition of a sociopath. And standing in that courtroom over there in Nevada, had a belly full of reds and Red Mountain wine. I didn't show any of those kind of emotions. That isn't no big deal. I know what it's like to shoot up out of my own bed 1 o'clock in the morning, laying next to a lady I love more than anything on the face of the earth. And I look at her, and she's got a black eye and a busted lip, and I'm pretty sure I got something to do with that. And I run down screaming inside of my head down a hallway where a little 10-year-old girl lays in her bed, and I put my ear down next to her mouth. And I listen to see if she's breathing, because it's just a matter of time till I kill her. I got her, don't you understand? Because they love me. Because they love me, and I hate me. I loathe me. I ain't living and I ain't dying. Everything about me is dying. You either attract all the things you love the most, or you attract all the things you fear the most. One or the other. There is no middle of the road. And now you either attract all the things you love the most, or you attract all the things you fear the most. And everything around me that was precious to me was going away. You know, you can take everything away from a human being, and they'll still be a human being, with the exception of one thing. Once you lose your dignity, you've got nothing left to lose. You have nothing left to lose. And I sold my soul for a drink of alcohol. I literally sold my soul. And I lived that way, not a day or a week or a month. I lived that way for the last 4 years of my life. I ended up in a motel room or an old barracks room over in Taft, California. You get a room over there for about $50 a year. And owed about $250,000 to people that you can't write them a letter and say, I'll send you $100 a month. And I was just crazy, and I was hiding out, and I was loaded, and I couldn't get sober, and I, you know, whatever I put in me didn't seem to do what it used to do, and yet I couldn't stop it because it was a phenomenon of craving inside of me that made it absolutely necessary for me to put something else in me. I went in there sometime in January of 1976, and about May the 6th, 1976, I crawled out of there one more time, and I went back home because I'm the kind of alcoholic that goes back home. I went back home, and my wife and my daughter left because they'd had enough. My wife stood in there and said, I don't hate you anymore, but I don't love you either. I can't stay here with you. And she left. I crawled around on that floor in there, tongue-chewing, babbling, drunk, down an old linoleum floor, lip-dragging drunk, big-time slick, lip-dragging drunk, gurgling, crawling up and down the floor in there for a couple of 3 days. And finally, I called Alcoholics Anonymous one more time. That's the worst thing about it. You get drunk and you don't die, you got to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? And 12-step call was made on me, and a guy by the name of Jack Callahan came over to my house and did a 12-step call on me. Little Jack, God, I love him. And came over there. I didn't meet him with a bunch of love and tenderness. I stuck a gun in his face and said, if you take me back to the nut ward, I just will kill you right now. And he did something he's never done before since. He jerked the gun out of my hand, shoved me down on the couch and said, you know, if you want to do something about it, well, I'll stay. And I was sweetly reasonable for a moment there. My wife and daughter were hiding in the other room, and he went and told them, you know, he was going to help me. He'd seen me around before, and he said he was going to take me and put me in a detox. I'm a product of detox. I got nothing bad to say about detox because I'd never been detoxed. I'd been trying to go to Alcoholics Anonymous for 4 years. And I never did have any length of sobriety really much. I had that 4 months at one time. And the other thing is I was going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and I'd hear all your good stories. I'd hear all those good things that people talk about here this weekend. And I'd get all jazzed, excited, and I'd go home and I'd walk in the house and I'd say, man, I've been to AA, everything's good, you know, we're going to do the deal and all, you know. And she'd say, I need some money, and I'd write her a hot check, and then a check would bounce, and then we'd have a fight, and then I'd get drunk. I'd go back to an AA meeting, I'd go in there and I'd sit and lust over the women, and I'd go home, my wife was all beat up and haggled, and, you know. And I'd say, get in the bedroom, I'm horny. And she said, no, you raped me long enough, you know, you're sleeping on the couch, you know. And we'd have a fight, and I'd leave and go get a hooker and go get loaded. And I'd go back to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and hear them talk about all these good things, you know, I'm not going to fight, I'm not going to cease fighting everything and everybody, you know, and all that stuff. And I'd go home, and I'd come in there, and she'd want some money, she'd want this, she'd want me to do that, and she'd get in my face with that finger, and the fight would be on, bam, the way we'd go, and I'd be drunk again. Because nothing was changing at my house. I could go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I was going home to a drunken environment. There was nothing changing there. And I went to that detox, and I said, in that detox long enough to know that, you know, something's got to change. And there's some absolutes. They're just as absolute for me today as they were then. Some absolutes. For me, I don't know what yours are. But I haven't hit anybody over 23 years. The violence had to stop. The book says you cease fighting everything and everybody. I haven't hit anybody. I've cheated on my wife, nor has she cheated on me in over 23 years. It wasn't because I didn't want her, it wasn't because I didn't need to, it was because I owe her an amends. See? See? And what that puts in a relationship is something I knew nothing about. It's called trust. Trust. See? The curse of a thief is that he can't trust himself. Trust. See? I didn't know that. How can you trust God if you're not trustworthy? Huh? I didn't know those things. I haven't written a hot check in over 23 years. You can't do that. I'm the kind of guy who puts $100 in 8 different banks and writes $8,000 worth of checks. You know? I can't do it. I went to that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in that detox. And there were 39 of us in there. And I'm forever grateful for H&I. First time I saw Rotten Ronnie come in there with a bunch of other guys in that hospital, detox down there, St. Joseph's Hospital in Orange. First time I seen him and come in there. You know. I had to have a sponsor to get out, you know. I had to work the steps, so I did my first inventory. I wrote from age 0 to age 12 or something like that, you know. You know, get right into it. And I had to get a book, and I had to do all those things. I didn't know what, you know. And so I said, in that detox, the last day I was in that detox, I stayed there for 6 weeks. And, you know, they explained to me. I stayed there long enough to get some physical sobriety, and they explained to me, you know, these things. And I heard them. And the last day I was in there, was 39 people in there. 39 people in there, and they went around counting me, and they went around the circle. It started on my left. 38 people said that I was a good old boy, but I was going to drink since I got out. Beginning of my first AA resentment, really, you know. And when it got to me, they were so convinced I was going to drink when I got out. I almost said, I'm going to drink when I get out. I said, to hell with you. Amazing thing. If you're new, relatively new, if you've been around here for a while, I'm going to tell you something. Screw the vote. Screw that vote. I'm the only one out of 39 that's still sober. And this ain't no popularity contest here, I'll guarantee you. See? And they taught me a very valuable lesson sitting in there. And I took that out. What that gave me when those people said I was going to, they were being honest. They were judging what, you know, my outside actions and everything else. People have done that all my life. But the fact that vote was 38-1, I'm going to tell you something. It lit the pilot light 2 inches behind my belly button and said, to hell with you. To hell with you. I'll stay sober. I stayed sober a year and a half on a resentment. And you can do that. It's a little rough, but you can do it. And my first birthday, where I went over, there was 11 of us out of 39. It could take a one-year cake. And all these people were reciting the book and the steps, and they'd done everything. I hadn't done nothing, just not drink, you know. I got up there and took my cake and said, I ain't drank, ain't used, and I ain't been in jail for a year. Thanks. You know, my wife's going to Alley Man, my kid's going to Alley Team, my dog's going to Alley Dog, the cat's going to Alley Cat. You know, I want to tell you something. Let me ask you a simple question. If this is Alcoholics Anonymous and this is singleness of purpose and you got a family that's sick with the disease of alcoholism, don't you think singleness of purpose for them should be Al-Anon and Alley Team? They ain't going to get it sitting in an AA meeting. I believe in family. How could anybody sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with children and say, look what I got. I got God in my life and everything's wonderful, but I ain't going to give that to my kid. He can't go to Alley Team. Where do you think they get their identity? Where do you think a child that's affected by the disease of alcoholism gets their identity? Where do you think they hear God? From another kid sitting in a meeting just like we do. Don't you think the steps would do that? If there's anything I want for my daughter, anything, with a 3-month-old baby girl, is to break that chain. If there's any prayer that is a constant prayer that she might do what she has to do so that it breaks that chain of alcoholism in my granddaughter, that she may never need to know what it's like to be loaded because she has a choice. Because she has a choice. Now, I'm going to stand here and tell you that I whooped it on them and everybody got cool. Because my sobriety is worse than a lot of people's drunk a lot. Because I brought me. You know? I brought me. And my wife went to Al-Anon and got this Al-Anon sponsor. And they released my ass. I had to pay that $250,000 back with interest. And my wife never helped me pay a nickel that back, nor did she want to be deprived of the manner in which she'd grown accustomed to living while I did it. It took me 14 years to pay that back. And I'm going to stand here and tell you, I never have had an overwhelming feeling that's good about that. Because I didn't have a damn thing to show for it. I'll tell you, though, I did it because I wanted to stay sober. That's all. Because I wanted to stay sober. And I didn't know what the hell to do. I was nuts. I was crazy. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous and everything's wonderful. I sat around radiated hate. It was the only feeling I knew. I don't understand people say, oh, I hate you, but I love you. How can you do that? If you can't do no better than that, get the hell out of the hate business. I hated everybody equal. You know? I remember I was standing over in Ron's shop one time. I was sober, I don't know, 6, 8, 9 months, and I'm over there radiating hate, just, you know, teeth gritting, just sober. And it was a rainy day. And he turned around and got a match, one of those little paper match cover things, tore the matches out of it, and got a little stubby pencil, that big. He said, here, why don't you go home and do your fourth step?
That's a hell of a thing to do to a slick guy like me. He should have given me a legal pad, you know, and a dozen pencils, you know. I mean, I wrote all the things I was afraid of. I wrote 150-some things that I was afraid of. Took it to him, and he drew lines in there. Reduced it to 10. He said, "You're not that big of a deal." I mean, I went to a meeting, and I went home and wrote number 11, all of the above at once. Unconditional fear. Because that's what I had. The book says that we're like a rubber band, and when we sober up, all those actions that we were taking out here, if we're trying to live sober, will unwrap, and they'll be the opposites. Where I was a violent drunk, I sober up, and it's going inward. See? Opposites. And I said, meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had so many guns on me, if you'd have bumped into me, there'd have been a mushroom cloud. You know? I was whining about it. I won some guy on Whitty or some money, and I was over at the Anaheim Lana Club whining about it, and Ron said, "Go take care of it." And I went over there to Whittier and went up and knocked on that guy's door, you know, and he was that big around. He was surprised as hell to see me, and I said, "I'm an AA. I'll make it right. Don't worry." And he's like, "Jesus, what are you?" And I ran down, got my old truck, went back over to the Lana Club, and Ron's sitting in there talking. He said, "Well, I told you to go to Whittier." I said, "I did." And she said, "He didn't kill you?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, I'll be damned." He said, "If it works, maybe I'll try it." Then I knew they were just testing me. They didn't send me out to do that crap, you know, see if it works. You know? I tried jogging. Tried running rather than work the steps. Wearing out them tennis shoes, about two pair a week. Out there running, running. Just crazy, yeah. Sober and crazy, just wonderful, yeah. I lost about 80 pounds in about 3 months. Standing in front of the mirror with that vanity, I could see my gut. I mean, you know, there wasn't much left. I could see my belly button. I could see a few other things down there that I hadn't seen in a long time, yeah. Of course, I'm dying, you know. I'm bleeding out of every opening in my body, you know, hemorrhaging, because I'm spiritual, yeah. And spiritual. Don't you know you're spiritual? You know, I can tell somebody's really spiritual. Check the red in their underneath their fingernails. If it's white, they may say they're spiritual, but they're damn near dead. You know? My fingernails were so white. I was laying in my house over there, 3.5 years sober, just slick. And my wife had to call a doctor, and the doctor called. And they come over there and wheeled my butt right out of that big old house. I'd 3.5 years. I was moving right along, wheeling a deal, and I got a big house for her, and a Cadillac in the driveway, and Rolex, and a pair of new boots, and you know, 3.5 years sober, they put me on a gurney, wheeled me right out of the house. They didn't let me put my watch on. Right by my boots, right by the Cadillac, right out in front of the neighbors, everybody in that gurney put me in that ambulance and hauled me off. Took me down and put me in an intensive care unit right next to a guy that owned the bar. He was in there drinking himself, down there to death. I'm 3.5 years sober. I'm bleeding out of every opening in my body. I'm in a, you know, a little curtain between us. And I remember as they wheeled me out of that driveway, I thought, I wonder who's going to drive my car when I'm gone. And they put 9 pints of blood back in me. That doctor told my wife, you know, if he didn't have enough blood in him, that if he'd have sneezed, he'd had brain damage. And she said, how would we have known the difference? They do stuff like that when you're down, you know. They run bone marrow tests and check me and everything else. And the doctor stood over me. And one more time, a doctor stood over an alcoholic. Don't make any difference whether you're drunk or sober. And said, we can't figure it out. You're just one of those 1% that just bleeds, you know. And I was laying there hating. No, there's nothing worse than having it and not knowing what to do with it. You know, I didn't know what to do with it. People in Alcoholics Anonymous came over and stood around that bed in that hospital and said, don't die, we love you. I hated them. They hated them. How can you say that? I've done everything I can to try to push you away. And done it all. Worked the steps. I never was afraid of the steps. I worked the steps. It didn't make any difference. Prayed. Called people to meeting. Secretary of the meeting. All that stuff. Doing that stuff. But inside, I'm dying. I'm dying. Dying, and I don't know why. Sitting in the back of a meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous and listening to you talk about all the good things that happened to you. It's like tattooed across my forehead. You're not nothing. You're never going to be nothing. You just might as well accept it. My wife's Al-Anon sponsor said, what if he's as good as he's ever going to be? I hated her.
But I knew she was right. A very good possibility. That's the best it could be. I didn't know if I was walking or riding a bicycle. I didn't know if I was Frank Ernest. I'd get up on Saturday morning, go to that Saturday morning meeting. I'd think, who am I? I'd run in there, look in front of the mirror. I'd put on my cowboy boots and my Levi's, my vest, cowboy hat, get in front of the mirror, do a couple of shit howdies. My wife would run over there and call her sponsor and get on the phone. I'd run out and kiss her goodbye and get my old pickup truck and head for the meeting. I'd get down there about a block from the meeting and I'd think, no, I'm not a cowboy today. Turn around and I'd go back and I'd get in there and run in the house and she'd still be talking to her sponsor. I'd go in there and put my leathers on, my bandana, you know, I'm a biker today. You know, I'd get in front of the mirror and do a couple of rib ups. I think I'm going to get my Harley and go down there and drive her right up them old timers' ass. Go out and kiss her goodbye, fire the Harley up, get down there about a block from the meeting. Sitting there and I think, oh, I'm kind of a marshmallow today. And I turn around and I go back over there to the house and I go in and I've been secretary of the meeting, so I got my, you know, Sunday go to meet and see and our closure suit on with a little hanky and a little tie and all that stuff. And I'd get that dictionary out and look up some of them $75 words so I'd be cool wearing a suit. And I'd recite them words, run out, kiss her goodbye, go out and get my big AA car and head for the meeting and get a block from the meeting. I forget all them big words. Hell, I can't go to a meeting with a suit on if I can't say no big words, for God's sakes, you know. So I turn around, I go back, park the car in the driveway, go in there, take my suit off, put my sweats on, go out and kiss her goodbye, and jog to the meeting. You know, why newcomers are tired when they get to the meeting. I had a few identity crises along the way, you know. My wife's sponsor said one time, how many people live in that house? Well, it's me and him. He's have a little identity crisis today, but he's got it down to four. That's a dilemma. And I don't know what to do. I had no clue what the hell to do. See? I am eternally grateful for the old-timers and Alcoholics Anonymous who have the wisdom and the knowledge to watch and wait and the patience. Understand that there has to be a surrender in sobriety, too. Oh, God. Don't talk to me about that. You know, my wife had said, when are you going to just be an alcoholic? What the hell are you talking about? See? And I was standing over there at the old Anaheim Alano Club. I was the secretary and treasurer of the meeting. I just got back from Vegas with my sponsor. We'd gone over there and I stole all the meeting money and left an IOU in there. I learned some things about me that I'd never known if I hadn't have gone, but what the hell, you know? And I'm standing over at the old Anaheim Milano Club, and I didn't have a clue what was going on. I didn't know. This is it. This is as good as it's going to be. I love them old-timers that wait and watch. Wait till you're just about to implode. You know? You're just cool. And I'm standing there. I didn't know. I look around, and a weirdo's standing next to me. Weirdest looking guy you ever seen. He wasn't short enough to be a midget or tall enough to be a man. Had a funny welder's hat down over one ear. And he standing there, a pair of shorts on, thongs. I said, what do you want? He said, will you be my sponsor? Oh, shit. I have done something terribly bad. And I'm finding it out now. This is a punishment. I'm going to have to take some jerk like that. And I was waiting on a doctor or a lawyer or somebody some bread to show up, you know, so I could borrow some money. You know? I went over to Ronnie, standing on the other side. He wouldn't even stand next to me. He'd stand on the other side of the room. He'd get newcomers. Come in, look at him. Look at old Drama over there. You know, I'm over there with my shades, my cowboy hat pulled down, you know, terminally cool. He'd point at me, you know. I asked one of the newcomers one time, I said, what did Ron say about me? He said, you know, Ron said if I go back out and drink, I could end up like you. You know? Sometimes the best you can be is your group's bad example, you know. Get moving right along, you know. Let them talk about you. That gives somebody else a rest, you know. I'm dying. I have a clue. See? Dr. Tebow talks about that thing. The alcoholic ego will revive itself irregardless of the length of sobriety, and it must be smashed in order to have continuous sobriety. I love the old-timers that know that. You know? They pay attention to you. They watch you. These guys come with me. There's 40 of them here. There's 5, 6, 7 generations of sponsorship there. We pay attention to each other. I don't have to stand up here and recite the steps to you. There's 5, 6 generations of sponsorship there. Because we pay attention to each other. Ron's sitting right there in the middle of them. 30 years of sobriety.
I love them people because they love me, and they knew the timing. The timing is so important.
And I got that guy in my car, and I started taking him to meetings, and he said, "You ever do anything like that?" And I said, "Yeah, I did some stuff like that." And I started telling him some of my stuff.
He said, "Man, you're sick. We need to go to a meeting, huh?"
Take him home. I go get him. We go to a meeting. Go there and hear some spiritual giant, you know. Go out in the car and get the Bible. And, "What are you doing, man? We got to read the big book." And he said, "No, we need a spiritual experience. We need a miracle." "What are you talking about?" And he said, "Oh, you know, like something that shocks us into spirituality, like a burning bush or, you know, something. Parting of the water." I think if I had some lighter fluid, I'd torch the hedge over here or something. You know, I just had a gun in the glove box. I got it out, run around in the chamber, stuck it up right beside his head and said, "You know, I'll count to 10. You pray. If I don't have a floating resentment inside to pop a cap on your ass, you've just done step 3, you know?" And I counted 10 real slow. He prayed and mumbled and jumped out of the car, went crazy, ran back in there and ratted on me, you know. Come back out and got in the car and we went home, you know. Showed up over at my house with a book and a bunch of blank paper in it, you know. And one do his fifth step, fourth and fifth step. And I said, "Well, you're supposed to have that done before you get to your sponsor's house." I said, "Do that." He said, "I can't write." He throws some blank paper in front of me and said, "I'll talk and you write." Started talking, I started writing. Then he said, "Did you ever do anything like that?" And I said, "Yeah, I did some stuff like that." Started telling him some of my stuff, you know. A couple of things came up I'd forgot to tell anybody. You know how it is, more will be revealed, you know. And I knew he couldn't read and God was in the room, so I just put a little of my shit in his. What the hell? God don't care. Get it out, huh? Yee-hoo! Boy, he carried some of my shit out that day. We burnt that one. That's what it's all about, lighting the load, baby. Man, he jumped up and kissed me on the cheek, and I thought, hell, divorce her and follow him, you know. When we prayed, he cuddled up underneath my arm, and I got that tingling sensation and checked my sexuality there for a minute. What the hell, everybody's hugging around here. Frank kissed me a while ago, by God, you know. I love it. See? So grateful. The people had the patience. And I had the fortitude and the constitution and the determination to stay sober one day at a time, no matter what, until I could get the message. Went from the head to the heart, from the head to the heart, the longest journey from the head to the heart. When I received the fifth step, I sit there and looked at that guy, and he told me all the things that he'd done. I knew it was absolutely impossible, looking him in the eye, to do the things that he said he'd done, and for me to try to do that and not get drunk. He literally gave me a conscience. Gave me a conscience by listening to those fifth steps. It's absolutely impossible for me to look you in the eye and listen to you tell me all your stuff and me to think I'm different. I'm not different. I'm just like you. I said here earlier, these character defects, man. Everyone wants to run in there and do step 5 and jump over to 8. You know, I did that. Everybody wants to work on that character defect. I worked on it. Damn near went to penitentiary sober. That's what I did. Everybody's, "I'll work on that character defect and drop it off." I went insane trying to figure out how far you have to drop it before it's off. There's some of them I like. Some of them are me. You know that a character defect's not a character defect to me until it causes me pain? It may be driving you nuts. But if it don't bother me, it ain't a character defect. You know? I love character defects. I like to just crank them up and charge right into them. See? I want to get rid of them. I want to be willing to get rid of them. Then I have to get out there and pedal. Get into it. Action. Get into that thing. Get into that thing. Cause some pain. You know, I prayed exactly the same number of times and the same exact amount as the pain that has been in. Pain is the touchstone to progress. The difference is I don't have to live in it today. See? I'm proud of my character defect. Because if it weren't for guilt, I wouldn't know when I'm wrong. If it weren't for my character defects. The difference is that I had to take those character defects and turn them into assets. Instead of trying to get rid of them, I turned them into an asset. I turned that anger into energy. I set up the chairs. I worked on committees, worked on conventions, worked with newcomers. I never needed anything but Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. Never looked for anything but Alcoholics Anonymous. Just to be an alcoholic. One drunk talking to another drunk. I get a daily reprieve today. Dependent upon my spiritual condition. And I get no spirituality from anything but talking to another drunk. I don't know about nobody else. But talking to another alcoholic, there's something spiritual happens. When I get out of myself. up to including the time I came to you in the very beginning, I was like an ingrown hair. All I could think about was me. What are you going to do for me? What are you going to give me? What are you going to get? What am I going to get out of this? Instead of what can I give? I got so desperate, sober, that I was willing to do anything. Do anything to stay sober. Do anything. Pay the money back. Be kind to that lady. Be a father to my daughter. I don't know how to be a father. I took my daughter. She was going to school, and she'd gone to Alateen, pulled her hair out of her face. The boys started noticing her. Asked her to keep score at a boys' basketball game. She lied to me, and I caught her in a lie. She came home, and she wanted to go back to school and do that basketball game, and I caught her in a lie. And my peers had told me, don't, you know, inflict a punishment on your child. It's more of a punishment on you than it is on the child. So I grounded her. And the next morning, she cried all night, and I laid in that room, and I said, God, hurt that kid so much. How can I do this? I said, the thing is, I had to remember the consistency. If I say I'm going to do something, I had to do it. I'm sober. Next morning, I got up and she wanted me to take her to school, and I rode up to that school and fell in front of that schoolhouse. She said, Daddy, I don't want to go in there and tell them people in there I can't keep score of that ball game tomorrow night or tonight. And I said, you only got that dope in there. And I could go use it. She knew how to push my butt. I asked God to give me the words, that quick, simple prayer that I'd uttered all my life. Sometimes you get it immediately, sometimes it's fast, sometimes it's slow. But that day, the one thing, because I knew one thing, and that's all I knew. And it applies today just as much as it did then. I looked her in the eye and said, Baby, I want to tell you something. I'm not going to that schoolhouse. You got to go in there by yourself, and I love you. Always be my little girl, no matter what. If you go in that schoolhouse and choose to put that dope in you, I'm going to tell you something. Before you put that dope in you, let me tell you something. The only thing I got to give you, remember where it took me. Because that's all I got to share with you. You hated me for what it did to me. And if you got to go there, you'll always be my little girl. But if you choose to put that stuff in here, don't come home because we got a sober house. And you got to get a new place to live. And remember where it took me because that's your greatest asset. And the kid's gone cheek and laid her out of the car, cried all the way home. When I got home, my wife asked me, you know, what's going on? And I told her. I said, it seemed like I should have been able to say something else, you see. But that's all I got. My past is my greatest test. That's all I got to give that kid. And she chose to make that choice because she was going to Alateen and she knew the difference. She was at that point in her life where she could make that choice. And she did. She's been active member of Alateen on up into Al-Anon. When she was 19, she went in Al-Anon and had to do another fourth step, fifth step, and her and I were asked to speak as father and daughter at a conference, and she was sitting on a fourth step. And I told her, I said, you know, you're sitting on a fourth step, you're 19 years old, and I'm not going to go with you and talk if you haven't done your fifth step. She said, you can't tell me when to do my fifth step, that's my business, and I'm not telling you when to do it, I'm telling you that I'm not going to go up in front of them kids and sit in the audience if you're sitting on a fourth step, because it's not fair to them, it's not fair to me. So she went to her sponsor and gave her fifth step away and came back. And the night she came home and she hugged me around the neck. She said, Daddy, I love you. Grateful you're sober. I'm working a program. He said, you don't remember that time you killed that dog in front of me? He said, I hated you. He said, but I come to understand it was the disease. It wasn't you. You love animals. You've been kind to animals all your life, but that was where you were in that disease. He said, in my fourth step, I had to share with my sponsor. My fifth step was that one time I was taking the laundry out of the dryer, and our cat jumped up in the dryer because the clothes were warm and it was cold in the house. That cat jumped up in that dryer, and she said, I slammed the door, and it spun that cat. Just a few seconds, she said, I gasped and recognized that I'd done something wrong, and I opened the door, and that cat jumped out and clung to me. She said, for a year and a half, I tortured that cat. I'd go put that cat back in there. You killed the dog. There was no torture there. The torture was to the people. I tortured the animal. I had to look at that. And she said, you know what, Daddy, the worst part about it and the best part about it? I've been running around here looking for a man that loved me like that. No wonder I can't have a relationship because my idea of love is that clinging, scared, fearful. No wonder. I'm grateful for those things. I was about 7-8 years sober. I got elected chairman of one of these conventions. Get involved in service because I noticed that a lot of people were disappearing at 10 years. So I was a head sick, you know, like that guy over there. We're having a committee meeting one Sunday, and after the committee meeting, I looked around. Because you're the chairman, you got to clean up the mess. So I was cleaning up the mess, and I had a newcomer with me, and my daughter was there with me. I was cleaning up, and I found a man's purse, an organizer. I'm not the kind of guy that carries a purse like that. Don't necessarily hang around people do, but they were on my committee, part of my entertainment committee. And that day, standing there, I picked up that purse, opened it up, and organized it, and automatically looked for the money. Because that's me. I looked, and the newcomer's looking at me, and the kid's looking at me, and I looked to see who it was. I found out whose organizer it was. I just went on with the deal and called the guy up, and I went to a meeting, gave him that organizer back, and he said to me, "Keith, I really appreciate this. You know, I had my credit cards, my checkbook, my organizer, my money in it. And so, is there anything I can do for you, let me know." I remember looking at that guy in my smug and arrogance. And I said, "Yeah, thank you. But I thought, you know, there'll never be nothing you can do for me, Ace. Just be damn glad you got it back." But I didn't say that. 4 years later, my daughter had a dream to be a model. She'd been to the Orient. She'd been all over. Come home and worked, and she had some money, and she wanted to go to Milan, Italy. She had a dream, and the Alateens had told her to look beyond where other people had feared to go, and she'd gone into Al-Anon and had a God in her life, and she had a dream to go to Milan, Italy. She didn't know how to speak Italian. She didn't know how to do anything, really, but she had hope, and hope is simply a vision beyond your present circumstances. And I took her down to LAX and gave her $100 in a round-trip ticket that she'd earned, and kissed her goodbye, her mother and I, and she went to Milan, Italy, with a dream and a God and a program. We didn't hear from her about 6 or 8 weeks. We didn't know whether she's dead or alive. She got over there and got sick, and nerves and everything. She couldn't communicate, nothing. Hunkered down the room. She tried to find Al-Anon. She couldn't find any Al-Anon because there really virtually wasn't any over there at that time. She finally found Alcoholics Anonymous, and some people in Alcoholics Anonymous that speak a little English came and got her and took her to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. She ended up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with 16 people. She's an Al-Anon sitting in a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. They went around the room, and the last person to share it was her, and because they weren't so narrow-minded and they were hungry for a program, they said, "Even though it's a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you'll share a program, we'll let you stay and share." And she shared her story, and she knew how to share a program in recovery. Sitting in that meeting was the guy I gave that organizer back to. He came up to her and he said, "Your dad, Keith Drummond?" She said, "Yes." And he said, "I owe him a favor." He said, "I was going to go home today, back to the United States. For some reason, I chose to stay. Now I know what it is." He said, "I'll take you home and get your stuff, and I'll take you over here and let you, get a place to live where there's other models, and I'll get you an agent. I'll give you the tape so you can learn the language, and when I go home next week, I'll tell your parents you're doing all right." That's 15 years ago. That guy came home and told us she was all right. Now, I'm not so egotistical to stand here and say, in fact, I did something right, gave that guy his billfold organizer back, saved my daughter's life, huh? But if I'd have been acting in Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean acting sober, like I did drunk, my daughter had never called Alcoholics Anonymous because she wouldn't have trusted me. She could have stayed in that room and died. If I hadn't have done something right, because the old-timers told me, "Don't do something today that'll get you by the throat 5 years from now." Maybe that deed, that guy wouldn't have owed that favor. My daughter's been actively involved in a program over there. She's been very instrumental in translating a tremendous amount of literature, both AA and Al-Anon, into Italian, because they had very little literature. She started speaker meetings, conventions, women's conferences. She sponsored women over there, a number of women. Started a step study over there. She used to ride a train every Wednesday night out to the NATO base with one or two other girls, and it cost $25 a person each way to go to a meeting and stay out there at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning and ride back. She's literally touched thousands of people's lives and still very active and involved. Matter of fact, Arbutus O'Neill is leaving next week. One of the oldest member of Al-Anon alive is leaving next week to go to my daughter's home group and put on a conference over there. Arbutus is 40-some years in the program, and she's going over there. My daughter's home group to bring her there to carry the message. My daughter married a young man, a very good young man. He's good. Good man. He loves my kid. He gave me a granddaughter. See? That's not a miracle story. I'm not telling you no miracle. We worked our ass off for that. Don't you let anybody say you can sit around here and pray. We worked our ass off for that.
We charged those character defects and took the goddamn pain and changed. Nothing's free around here. And nothing's easy.
That's why 97% of the alcoholics die drunk.
I don't think this is easy. It's the toughest thing I ever did in my life. The guy came up and punched me in the chest and said, "You think you're tough, babe? Let's see you stay sober." And he wasn't shitting. To change, I'm afraid to change. Don't you understand? I'm afraid to change. But I gotta change because I don't want to be the same me. The same me will always drink again.
So I share with you very quickly a simple story. You may not remember nothing else, but you'll remember this. There was a family living in Europe. Mother, father, little girl. They had a dream. The dream was that they wanted to come to America. They had very little money, so they worked their rear off to save their money, buy a ticket on this great ocean liner that sailed into this little small town where they lived. And they worked and worked and put their money together. They had very little. Came the time they had enough money to buy passage on that ocean liner. And they went down and bought the ticket, packed all their stuff, everything they had, and they got on that ocean liner and got in their room, opened the porthole and looked out. Their dream was coming true. They loved each other more than anything. Love was an abundance. They were so excited because it was happening. And the great ocean liner sailed off, and for 4 days they sat in that room and talked about what's going to be like when their dream comes true and they get to America, home of brave, land of the free. Man, it's going to be great. After 4 days sitting in that room, that little girl said, "Daddy, I know it took all our money. The only thing we got to eat is crackers and cheese. I'm tired of crackers and cheese. I can't stand it any longer. I've got to have something else." The father, being a good father, pulls some money out of his pocket, nickel, whatever. So here, go out in the galley and get an ice cream cone. The little girl left and she was gone an hour. Mother and father were worried sick. They couldn't imagine what happened to her. Sitting in that room just amazed. They couldn't imagine, what's gone wrong? What's happened? Pretty soon there's a knock at the door and there stood the little girl. She had a smile from ear to ear. And the father said, "Where have you been? You've been gone for an hour. You were worried sick." And she said, "Oh, Daddy, I went up to that galley and I had a steak and I had potatoes and I had two ice cream." And the father said, "You can get steak and potatoes and two ice creams for a nickel?" And she said, "Oh, sure, Daddy. The food's free. It comes with a ticket." Now, that's not a story about love. There was an abundance of love. That's a story about ignorance and teachers. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with crackers and cheese, folks. And many of you did, too. I'm not satisfied with that today. I want more. But there's people in Alcoholics Anonymous that are satisfied with crackers and cheese. So be careful of your teachers. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous ignorant. And these steps have made me a survivor of my own ignorance. Not smart, but wise. Wise by experience. Don't settle for crackers and cheese. You don't have to. And let me tell you something. God's free. He comes with a ticket. Thank you.